You're listening to The Bulletin with UBS, first broadcast on the 26th of April 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24. Each week we'll be hearing from the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance, taking you beyond the numbers and the hype and getting to the heart of the big issues of the day. This week, we're looking back at the IMF World Bank Spring Meeting and considering some of the key talking points. In particular, we're going to investigate the so-called super taper tantrum, and we'll hear what the impact of this is likely to be and how it might have reshaped the emerging market landscape. Plus, a little later in the programme, we'll find out about how new extra-governmental initiatives are being designed to tackle some of the short to medium-term challenges presented by these economic and geopolitical shifts. We start with Jorge Mariscal, Regional CIO, Emerging Markets at UBS. So what exactly is the super taper tantrum? How has it come about and why should we be worried?
We had a taper tantrum in 2013 when the Fed first announced that they were going to end the quantitative easing program. The currencies and equity markets of many of the fragile economies around the world had a pretty significant shock back then, just with the prospects of ending quantitative easing. So now that the Fed is closer to beginning its actual hiking cycle, many central bank and other policymakers in the emerging world and many investors are concerned that now things are going to get potentially even worse since rates are actually going up, not just the end of quantitative easing.
Maximiliano Castelli, head of strategy in the Global Sovereign Market Team at UBS Global Asset Management, was in Washington, D.C. for the meeting, too. And he explains what he thinks the driving forces behind the taper tantrum are.
I was in Washington, D.C. For 1 week during the spring meetings of the IMF and the World Bank. And, of course, the super taper tantrum was one of the topics of discussion in many parts and all in the different panel where I was involved. And actually also the IMF came out with some reports on the potential spillover effect of an eventual rise in U.S. interest rates. I mean, the super tantrum is basically being driven by the steady improvement in the U.S. economic outlook. For instance, over the last year, we saw a positive job creation and a falling unemployment rate, which is reducing the scope for monetary easing and quantitative or so-called unorthodox monetary policy in the U.S. So from a certain point of view, the tantrum is the effect of a sort of what we call a normalization in the U.S. monetary policy. From that point of view, I mean, after several years of the zero level interest rate in the U.S., there is basically uncertainty in the global market on what will be the impact of a natural rise in the U.S. short-term interest rate. This is particularly true when one considers what we have seen in the middle of 2013, when there's a simple hint to a possible U.S. monetary policy normalization actually had a very disruptive impact on capital markets, I would say particularly with regards to emerging market asset classes.
And here's the view of Nick Rice, Global Emerging Markets Product Manager for the CIO at UBS Wealth Management.
Well, I think what the IMF is concerned about primarily is the effect of future Fed rate rises on emerging markets. The Fed has signaled it will raise rates. It will most likely raise rates this year. That increases the cost of financing for emerging markets and emerging market companies that have financed themselves in dollars. It also puts upward pressure on the dollar, so it just makes dollar financing in general more expensive for emerging markets. Now, we've already seen worries around this when the Fed announced it would end its quantitative easing program, which it subsequently did. In May 2013, we had a taper tantrum in which a number of emerging markets became embroiled and people were rather afraid for their finances because, of course, the end of quantitative easing was the beginning of the end for the Fed's ultra-loose monetary policy, from which emerging markets had definitely benefited on the financing side. So I think what the IMF is afraid of primarily is a repeat only on a grander scale when the Fed starts raising rates.
Let's consider next, in broad terms, what shape emerging markets are in. How does Nick Rice believe they're set to perform?
I think overall they are in better shape. I mean, the 2013 taper tantrum was really a wake-up call to emerging markets to deal with things like their financing arrangements, to deal with things like current account deficits and fiscal matters. So, I mean, some emerging markets are in better shape than others. That's certainly true. We think, for instance, that what we term the new fragile five, so Brazil, Russia, Indonesia, Turkey, and South Africa, might prove particularly vulnerable to Fed rate rises and a consequent shortage of global liquidity. Equally, there are some others, such as India, Philippines, Taiwan, which we think are in a bit of a better position. But overall, I think, you know, the original taper tantrum did provide enough of a wake-up call for emerging markets at least to start to get their house in order. I mean, there is some progress that needs to be made in future, but the process has definitely started.
Panu Bawaja runs Emerging Markets Cross Asset Strategy at UBS Investment Bank. He explains why he thinks a number of emerging markets have not seized an opportunity that was available to them.
Some emerging markets that have healed, right? I mean, the external deficits in India have come down tremendously. Indonesia, the external deficit has come down. But I've got to say, for the most part, the degree of healing in EM has been limited, right? South Africa, Brazil, Turkey are three economies that spring to mind, which really haven't healed as much as they should have. So, on balance, have emerging markets taken the time that has been afforded to them by low rates to completely change the structure of their economies, to become more competitive, to go and substitute imports for domestic production? I'm afraid that's not been the case at all. So I think EM here, for the lack of a better expression, is cruising for a bruising if US rates go up.
One notion that has been discussed is the idea of a change in the makeup of the list of so-called Fragile Five group of nations, those most fragile in the face of these pressures. Why has this happened? Jorge Mariscal takes up the story.
The main change, I think, is India, who I would say has graduated from the Fragile Five and is no longer as fragile as it used to be. They've turned around their current account imbalance. Now they have a very small imbalance. They've brought down inflation quite a bit, and the rupee has also depreciated significantly. So they're in much better shape now than they were back then. On the other hand, you have countries like Russia, who as a result partly of the decline in oil prices, partly of the sanctions that have been imposed on them because of their actions in Ukraine, look a lot more vulnerable. We're looking at Russia to have a recession of negative 4% GDP growth this year. And so Russia appears to us more vulnerable now than it did back in 13. And India appears more resilient.
Despite the fact of emerging markets' relative good health compared to 2013, there is still belt tightening, and poorer areas of society may be more vulnerable. Ahead on the Bulletin with UBS, we'll consider what can and should be done to address this and look in more detail at some specific extra-governmental initiatives. So what role can other initiatives, be they extra-governmental or commercial, play in tackling some of these challenges? Phyllis Costanza is the CEO of UBS Optimus Foundation, serving UBS clients by helping them to do smart philanthropy and dedicated exclusively to children across health, education and child protection programs. The kind of initiatives she's involved with, like the Power of Nutrition Plan, what role do they play?
Government budgets are constrained everywhere, in emerging markets in particular. So there's a real challenge that governments are facing on, they have plans to address key challenges, but they have no money to do it. So the question is, how do we prioritize? And much of that is based on a value system, but there is a lot of work that's done around the economics of certain interventions. And one of those areas that has been studied tremendously is undernutrition. The Copenhagen Consensus said that addressing undernutrition should be our number one priority because it results in 11% of lost GDP, and then the human toll, 3 million children die directly of undernutrition and 165 million children are permanently impaired because of it. So there's a lot of economic arguments for it, and for every $1 that's put into programs to fight undernutrition in emerging markets, there's a $46 payout. So I think there's the human toll, but there's also a tremendous economic market argument to be made for investing in undernutrition. And so UBS Optimus Foundation is partnering with the World Bank, with UNICEF, Children's Investment Fund Foundation and Department for International Development in the UK to bring more and better money to fight undernutrition.
We asked Jorge Mariscal about the program, as it was discussed at length at the spring meeting.
The large population countries like India, Indonesia, Vietnam, and then, of course, many countries in Africa with large populations still are lacking in terms of absolute poverty levels and income distribution and many of the things that developed countries today enjoy. So I think that we cannot rely on the markets for the solution to all of these problems, and I think these sort of private sector initiatives or private-public initiatives go a long ways, as we have seen in the cases of some of the diseases that have been fought by private sector means and the progress made on those fronts. They go a long ways to address these issues at the markets by themselves. So they're welcome initiatives, in my view.
To what degree are extra-governmental projects and initiatives like this vital? Nick Rice again.
Government financing in emerging markets and government budgets are clearly under pressure. So even before the taper tantrum, there were plenty of gaps in public service provision in emerging markets that either philanthropic or private sectors could come in and fill. Now that phenomenon has just become all the greater, right? So there are definitely opportunities for private sector to come in and fill gaps in areas like healthcare, education, digital infrastructure, also for some philanthropic players to come in as well. One of the things that we were exploring and talking about at the IMF World Bank meetings is the power of nutrition, which is a venture to combat malnutrition, which we have engaged in alongside UNICEF, the World Bank, and other private sector players. So definitely plenty of opportunities for private sector players, philanthropic players to come in.
This partnership that was discussed at the World Bank IMF meeting is one of the largest leveraged financing giving campaigns for early childhood care. Does it represent a step change in approach? Phyllis Costanza, again.
I think it's a critical initiative, and I think the timing is right. And I think it also marks a milestone for UBS and UBS Optimus Foundation to be engaged on this level. We're thinking about innovative ways that we can use our expertise in financing and in access to wealthy individuals to help address some of the critical challenges that are facing the world. And this is one of those. And we know, based on the work of Nobel Prize winner James Heckman, that addressing early childhood care and development is the greatest economic benefit, and fighting undernutrition in the first 1,000 days of life is a component of that. So by partnering with all of these global players and also with the governments in which we're working, we can leverage client donations up to 6 times, which is tremendous. Clients love to see that. And we also are hoping to first of all, bring more money to the sector, which is desperately needed. As you mentioned, government budgets are constrained. So we want to see new money coming into this issue because there isn't enough fighting undernutrition. And secondly, bringing better money. So if people are spending money, philanthropic money, on issues that aren't having as great an impact, there's certainly a strong case to be made that they should consider the case for undernutrition and putting their money into undernutrition because of the tremendous toll it has on children and on economies.
Phyllis Costanza on the Power of Nutrition project run by the UBS Optimus Foundation. In conclusion then, when it comes to the super taper tantrum, there are a number of fears and concerns many people have, be they related to emerging market economies, government spending, asset prices and so on. But are these risks, frankly, not quite so great? Here's Nick Rice's conclusion.
I think emerging markets have gone some way to mitigating those risks, but those risks still remain. I don't think that some emerging markets have done enough reform, for instance, to stimulate their economies in the absence of easy dollar financing. I think that there are some nations, such as India, for instance, which have made very prominent progress in India's case since the Narendra Modi administration came in last year. But there are some emerging markets which have not been particularly open to reform. Brazil has made only very limited progress, for instance. Russia has made almost no progress at all. So I think the reaction to the Fed rate rise, when it does come, is going to be still a little bit mixed.
And that is Nick Rice bringing us to the end of this 29th edition of The Bulletin with UBS, setting the agenda in the fast-moving world of finance each week here on Monocle 24. Listen again and find out more at monocle.com or catch up via iTunes or SoundCloud. The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24.